Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So without those failures, it forced me to reflect on what it was I was getting out of it. It means that I am both proud of the achievement and content with the experience, which could be mutually exclusive. So I'm very happy I failed, incredibly happy.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with Mark Agnew. Mark is a journalist and in some ways an adventurer, but we discussed this right at the start of the episode. He's become well known recently for his crossing of the Northwest Passage as part of a kayak-based team, which we believe is the first recorded crossing of its kind. But in this episode, we don't focus solely on the details of Mark's crossing. This is a broad and far-reaching conversation. We discuss Mark's early life in Scotland, his decision to move to Hong Kong. We talk about his ancestry and the pressure of living up to his adventurous roots. We discuss intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation and the difference between focusing on firsts, greatests, fastests, and biggests, and simply just enjoying journeys for their own sake. We also explore two failed ocean rowing attempts and the impact that that had on Mark. This episode really is an exploration of the psychology and headspace of an adventurous mind. I also want to very briefly mention we've now launched the Adventure Podcast Plus, where free subscribers get access to a newsletter that features links, insights and opinions on the world's adventure and exploration. Paid subscribers get access to a whole load of new bonus content, including a monthly Q&A with a guest, access to filmed InVision podcasts, access to our shorter form podcast, The Dispatches, and subscriber-only posts and articles. To get involved, head to theadventurepodcast.substack.com. And finally, before we start, I'll just give a huge shout out to the Martin Moran Foundation, our charitable partner, who help people from disadvantaged backgrounds get outdoors, upskill, and fall in love with mountains. If you're in a position to, please consider donating to the foundation. Okay, over to Mark Agnew. Thanks very much for doing this. I think the logical, obvious place to start is if you could introduce yourself, tell me who you are and what you do.
Hello, I am Mark Agnew. What I do most of the time is probably writing as a journalist, parenting to young children, religiously following Scottish rugby, but also recently I did a big adventure. I'm not sure if that qualifies me as an adventurer. I'll just say I did an adventure, which is why I'm here, and hopefully do more adventures in the future. And that was a difficult question to answer. Who are you? Like, sum yourself up. Right? I don't know. Chuck in rugby.
Yeah, totally. And I've talked in previous podcasts, actually, one particular lady referenced this whole idea of, are you a runner or do you just go running? Are you an adventurer or do you occasionally?
I've thought about that a lot. I've had that argument with some friends and I a few years ago. We rode from Newcastle to Orkney and I was saying, I'm not a rower. And everybody was saying, I'm pointing at the rowing boat and saying, Exhibit A, you are a rower. And I'm like, no, I'm just like, I guess, outdoorsy. You know, rowing is the same for me as camping or hiking or cycling or kayaking or whatever. I just happen to be rowing now. I'm not a rower. And I would have had said 10 years ago, I am a rugby player. You know, I train 3 times a week and then I go to the gym for rugby and I play on Saturdays and I think about it and it's who I am, Mark the rugby player. Whereas now I'm not Mark the rower. Like I just happen to be rowing now. And yeah, I just kayak the whole Northwest Passage. I'm definitely not a kayaker.
Yeah. And we'll gloss over this fast because it gets, I think I've talked about it so much, but it, I think adventurer has become a dirty word. Like it's, I would never ever describe myself as an adventurer. And I don't know if many would with my career, but I'd say I'm adventurous, very adventurous.
Yeah, I think I say outdoorsy. I mean, we spoke about this while we're in the Northwest Passage. Are we on an adventure or an expedition, and what's the difference?
Well, that's a whole different thing. I think probably both, but maybe we'll get there.
I like the Al Humphrey thing, which I heard him talk about on your podcast. Like, if you feel like you're on an adventure, then you are.
Totally. I completely agree with that. Yeah. My toddler has adventures all the time.
Exactly.
Ace, so it sounds like, I mean, maybe you could do a bit of background on where you grew up, what life was like. It sounds like it was adventurous in lots of ways.
So I grew up in Edinburgh, despite my accent. I'm cursed sounding English. Probably the question I get asked every single time I meet somebody is, why don't you sound Scottish? So I grew up in Edinburgh with two fairly adventurous parents. My mum was an adventurer in the sense that she just, when she was about 20, just moved to Australia, worked there for a while, and then worked her whole way back overland through Southeast Asia and the Middle East over about 4 years back to the UK, which is a woman who's 20-something in the 70s was pretty extreme, even more extreme in many ways than what my dad did, who was a literal explorer. Like, if we're talking about the nuances between the descriptions, he mapped part of Patagonia, which is an indication of how old he is, and was, you know, climbing unnamed peaks in Greenland and leading expeditions in the Himalayas and stuff like that. So it was sort of humming along in the background, but it's not like we were regaled with stories over dinner with like dad's epic adventures and stuff. And my mum is more of a storyteller, and she'd always say, like, what are you going to tell your grandkids? You know, if you say, oh, my friend's got, like, look at this job he's got. That sounds so great. Straight out of university, he'd already paid this. And yeah, but what's he gonna tell his grandkids? So which is nice, but in other ways have given me this sort of like existential dread that I have to be doing something interesting all the time. Otherwise, I have no stories for my grandkids. So yeah, a lot of our holidays were like camping and hiking and, particularly around Scotland. I had three older sisters, so couldn't take big holidays abroad without it being a nightmare. And but I'd say most of my sporting stuff, this makes me sound like I'm roaming around the hills, was, as I said before, just playing rugby. By the time I was a teenager, that's all I wanted to do. And I was playing all week and school on Saturday and clubs on Sunday, which has become very relevant to me as an adventurer. I now look back on why I enjoyed rugby, and I thought it was because we were good and we won and rugby's fun for X, Y, and Z. But now I realize it's because the camaraderie in rugby is very high because it's such a committing sport. And through my adventures, I'm basically trying to like recreate what I had, which is an incredibly committing endeavor, camaraderie for a shared goal. So I guess that's one of the biggest ways it's informed me as an adventurer now. And and then after university, I moved to Hong Kong, which was also incredibly important in becoming a outdoors person, because Hong Kong has some of the best outdoors, so accessible to the city. So rather than just going on hikes when I could arrange it, I was hiking like every weekend, sometimes after work, all the time. It's a massive ultra running community, so it exposing me to more and more like normal people doing massive things. And I got a job as an adventure sports editor for the South China Morning Post, which is the big newspaper out there, which exposed me even more and more to like bigger and bigger stories. So if the reason I'm telling my background is how did it lead to me becoming somebody interested in kayaking the Northwest Passage? Well, incrementally, parents, rugby, Hong Kong, the job as a journalist, it all played a part to getting to here.
So why did you move to Hong Kong?
I just wanted to live outside the UK, not because I dislike the UK. In fact, I really like it, but just thought young and I've got to have kids for the stories for the grandkids. So I've got to go somewhere. And it could have been anywhere. In fact, I think I wanted to move to Northern Italy. I thought my passport abroad would be my rugby. You know, I'm definitely not good enough to be a professional, but there's like a level down where they pay for your flat and give you an allowance. And as a club in Hong Kong, gave me a flat for the first 6 months and gave me a few hundred pounds for the first 3 months and gave me introductions to get a job. So I went out there, played rugby, became an English teacher while I looked for something more permanent and became a journalist at a small newspaper, bigger newspaper and then the biggest newspaper there. So, it just happened to be Hong Kong, but it could have been anywhere.
And when I was kind of doing my obligatory reading and research before we chatted, I read, you know, you have done a crazy amount of ultramarathons and things like that. And
a crazy amount is, I haven't done a crazy amount. I've done some ultramarathons. Maybe I need to reword my website. It makes it sound like I'm some kind of mad ultra runner. I've covered a lot of ultra running because in Hong Kong, it's got this like amazing, amazing ultra running community. Every weekend, especially from about October to March when it's like cooler, you can sign up to one of several ultra marathons. And the biggest one there, the Old Town Trail Walker, has got 4,000 runners, and then all of them have support runners. There's probably 15,000 people on the trail at once. And it's just the norm, you know, you just look around a group of people and say, you know, who here has done the 100-kilometer Maclos? You know, oh yeah, I did it with my work team. We did it as a one-off, even if it's just like a one-off. Like they aren't, I'm an ultra runner. They just have done an ultra run. So yeah, I've probably done five or something. My wife always tells me, it reminds me that she's done more every time. Yeah, I mean, when I signed up to 100 kilometers, she was like, oh, now I'm going to have to do it just so I can beat you. And then I'm going to have to hear a story about how resilient you were. And yeah, she beat me like 2 hours. So yeah, I've done some. But yeah, as I say, I wouldn't say I'm an ultra runner. I'm certainly not a good one.
Well, I'm interested in whether or not that was a kind of a transition point for you, because obviously very athletic, sport-focused, fit. But ultra marathons generally and ultra running is a wilderness experience in some way or another due to the nature of the event. So were you entering those as a test of your physicality, or were you already into playing in the outdoors? Or was it a mix of the two?
Well, I'd say two things. I was very much already into the outdoors, but and I hadn't done an ultra marathon when I first moved to Hong Kong, because I was worried about getting injured, because my goal was to row the Atlantic. And I am sporty, but I wouldn't say I'm like athletic. And I would definitely say I'm not naturally fit. So like getting fit, it takes me twice as long to get half as fit as other people. So I didn't want to have to commit all that time. And I thought I'll come back from the Atlantic and try an ultra marathon, just because I know so many people doing it. But I was hiking all the time. And then when I failed to row the Atlantic once and then twice, the second time it really crushed me. Like, you know, I had this idea of myself as this adventurer, resilient, I was going to overcome this and that, and then I'd fail twice, and like it struck at, you know, we've talked about identity before, well, it like was an identity crisis. I felt really pathetic and worthless, and so I did enter ultra marathon specifically with the idea in mind of either building resilience or testing my resilience. And I had this 100-kilometer race that I was building towards, which is the only time I've done 100 kilometers. My knee completely and utterly blew out, like 6K in. And, you know, I was like crabbing sideways and going really slowly. And it was just the right amount of suffering. So, you know, I like then did a 90-something kilometers on this bus knee and finished. It was like just the right amount of suffering for me to like be like, yeah, you know what? I'm not pathetic. You know, I've done it. So like it was specifically with that in mind. And now, yeah, and now I've done it. And I think I'll never do an ultra marathon again, because what I like is the wilderness experience. I don't necessarily need the suffering. I think if I did it regularly, my knees would be shot within a few years. So I just like hiking now. I'm like, if I want to go and do a trail, I'm just going to hike it, because I do get what I'm looking for without having to like suffer.
I mean, I'm really interested to go into that in detail. But I think the question I'd like to ask first is, why did you want to row the Atlantic?
Well, that I think I forgot why. So when I just got a message from a friend on Facebook with a video of people rowing the Atlantic, we should do this. I thought that would be super cool. And we completely naive about the admin and the money and whatnot. We sort of said, oh, we'll graduate. You know, you can't graduate without having a good time. So we'll make sure we have like a month before we take this seriously. And then we'll pick it up in July, August, and then we'll row the Atlantic in December. You know, not realizing it's like a 2-year process. So it took us a while. And then we found a guy on the internet who was like selling spots. He's like, I guess, a guide, paper place, they call it. And he was saying, yeah, I need a crew and I'm going to set the world record and yada, yada. And, you know, I didn't even contemplate beforehand that people in this space set world records. I thought that was for the Olympics, not for rowing the Atlantic. But that suddenly was like what we were going to do. And then I became so focused on that. We're going to set the world record. We're going to set the world record. We were rescued like after 48 hours. This guy, if you Google him, had articles going all the way back to the 1990s saying Captain Calamity. And my problem was like, I was so determined and emotionally and financially invested that it's easy to rationalize away red flags by that point. So 48 hours were plucked off. And then I was like, right, we're going to do it again, like before it even like touched down on the helicopter, like already thinking about it. And then 2 years later, tried again in a pair, a mixed pair. We're going to set the mixed pair world record now. And we only got about 3 days in and were picked up after 5 days. That was the one that crushed me, because the first one, the first one, there was like no ambiguity. We have to get off. The second time there was like, is this safe? Isn't this safe? Kind of thing. And I decided it wasn't, and I got off. And did I chicken out? Did I grab a face-saving excuse about like failing batteries, which weren't as bad as they were in reality? And I took that excuse. So that's what like ate at me. And the realization that I came to was, why did I want to row the Atlantic? Well, I'd become so focused on records. I'd forgotten that the reason I want to was because of the immersion in nature and the camaraderie. People kept saying to me, why don't you do it yourself? You keep getting let down by different crewmates and captains and whatnot. I would never do it by myself. And all of these kind of things made me realize that, fine, like a record would be great. And I like having that performance goal as like a facilitator to push yourself. But I just become so utterly transfixed by that kind of binary outcome. And by the time I got to the Northwest Passage, and certainly now, I realized that like adventure isn't the finish or the start. It's like everything in between. And if you want to be a world record holder, you want to finish. If you want to be an adventurer, you have to want to everything that happens before that.
I mean, it's so fascinating. And I get the sense, we don't know each other. It's worth saying, because sometimes people I'm speaking to on this podcast, I know very well. Like, we've just met. But yeah. I get this sense
and
you're
now
quite
we're
open.
Best friends.
Yeah. I get this sense that you're quite open to talking about failure and where your head's at. And maybe some of your kind of, we spoke about this just before we started, but we're allowed to change our minds. We're allowed to grow. We're allowed to mature. And we're allowed to have got things wrong. And I just would like to dig into a little bit why you were so goal focused. Was it?
What happened? I don't know. I think that it was maybe as simple as like just somebody suggesting that you set the world record and then it appealing to me. Being young as well, this is 8 years ago now. I'm not that old, I'm 32, but there's a lot that happened between now and then, and I've had kids. I guess like, and everybody likes the external validation. Like, how cool would it be to be a record breaker? It's not like I've moved on entirely and I'm now like, otherwise I would have picked a kayaking trip where I just kayaked in circles and wherever I wanted on any given day. I picked one with a goal in the end. I think part of it was that I'm circling back to rugby. Like, at my high school rugby team, we were really good. We won this like national trophy. I felt like I was an important part of the team. And I just misunderstood why I enjoyed it. I was like, oh, wow, like that was such a good experience because we won, I was good, we were good. And now I'm going to take that, what I enjoyed from that, and apply it to ocean rowing. Whereas I look back and I'm like, that's because it was for my best friends in a great time of my life. And we had this incredible experience doing something together that had a shared goal that facilitated all the other stuff. And the catalyst, I suppose, for like reflecting on that was just somebody pointed out a piece of psychology to me by these two people, Katrina Douglas and David Careless, I think. And they say there's only three reasons people take part in sport: performance, discovery, and relationships. And as soon as they said that, I thought, yeah, performance is what I've become focused on, but I wanted discovery and relationship. It was just like gave me the language to articulate to myself my exact motivations. And the problem with performance is it's binary. You either win or you lose. Discovery, for me, meaning immersion in nature. Relationships, for me, meaning camaraderie. Whether you finish or not, you can judge success on your own terms. They are intrinsic. They are like, and they're way more like lasting and rewarding and all of these things. And I'm still focused on performance, but no longer as an outcome, but as a facilitator of the other two. Because if you have a performance goal that you're pushing for as a group, then those relationships become camaraderie rather than just a random shared experience. So it's still like important, but it's not the be all and end all. So yeah, I mean, I've had a very roundabout way there. Why did I become performance focused? I don't know. Lots of different things, being young, wanting it, misunderstanding why I enjoyed sport before, somebody suggesting it to me and me just latching onto it. I think also sponsorship, you need to have something to get sponsors. And I began to believe my own deck too much.
That's a good line. Yeah, because I think that is, it's another thing that we don't talk about loads is, and I think this is okay. You know, I make a living out of creating branded content, which often means I'm following athletes on very well-funded adventures and I'm being paid. Like, I won't pretend I'm not, but clickbait is real. You know, hype is real. It's why people gun for Everest and the 8,000ers rather than climbing an unclimbed peak in Kyrgyzstan, because it doesn't make the press as well. Mm. And so if you are a professional inverted commas, adventurer, well, what's your tick? You know, what's your big scoop?
Yeah, and you've got to balance it as well. I mean, before I kayaked the Norfolk Passage, I was trying to row it with a team who called it the last great first, which for a while I believed, because I still probably hadn't, I'm not sure if I'd come across the research yet about the performance discovery and relationships. I thought the last great first, that's even better than the record. And now I cringe at that, you know, which was a mixture of growing up, being a bit more mature, a few angry emails from people like accusing me of like colonialism. The Black Lives Matter movement made me reflect on my place in the world as a white man with a platform going to a place with an indigenous community. Just, and also the discovery and relationships element made me realize what I wanted out of it. So all of these sort of things. And I look back on that, I think that is utter nonsense, last great first thing. And I even pitched a few articles to different newspapers about, like, is there a last great first? Because the lastgreatfirst.com is two people trying to recreate Shackleton's journey in the moment, and the rowing around Antarctica, doing the Norfolk Passage. I heard somebody recently talk about the last great first was getting to the pole of inaccessibility on the Arctic Ocean. So AKA an arbitrary point about like 200 miles away from the other arbitrary point that's the North Pole.
I could, and I won't, because this is not I'm the interviewer, so I'm not going to go off on one. But I've done talks about this and sat on stages and spoken about this at length. And all I will say in response to it, because I agree with everything you're saying, is there still remains to this day more unclimbed mountains in the world than climbed mountains.
Oh, that's cool.
And I just think if there's one thing that says we might have another golden age of exploration, which again, it's tangential, but I think that involves science, the future golden age of exploration. Let's remember that, you know, I mean, I've been to bays in Scotland that have had fewer people on them than the summit of Everest, you know. There's there are mountains in India that have five-digit names because no one's got around to naming them yet. Number names, you know. Like, it's all there to be done. There are so many. There are thousands and thousands of last great.
To say there's a last one, but even to say there's a great one, I don't think it's... The last is obviously nonsense, but great, I think, is A, subjective, and B, if you go to Antarctica, fine, call it a great first. And it probably is. And what we did was great with a small g. But to say, like, I don't know, a place where Inuit live, say the last great first, like anchors it in like the Victorian exploration. Big G great, like, and I'm not saying, it's not like I listen to the Black Lives Matter movement and just become woke overnight. Like, those people still like inspire me, and those stories are part of the reason I wanted to go there. And it was very rewarding to see those places and think of the stories I'd heard. Or to say, oh, it was all terrible, you know, like, I'm not in a position to speak on behalf of the communities there and say that they don't want some of the aspects of modernity. But to boldly claim that, as some people caught me out on emails, it's just cringe. It's so cringe.
But it comes back to the point around we're allowed to get things wrong and we're allowed to change. I'm certainly guilty of it.
People still email me though a lot now about saying you're not the first people to do the Northwest Passage by kayak because the Inuit did, which I just think is probably not true. A misunderstanding of what the Northwest Passage is, it's in the name. It's northwest of Europe. Like,
yeah,
it's an invention. It's not like around Ireland, for example, which is like it's rooted in a geographical thing. Like, it's a concept, and it's only a concept because Europeans were interested in it. So to think that an Inuit would care enough about that route and want to go from Baffin Bay to Beaufort Sea would be crazy for them to do that for absolutely no reason.
Yeah. So it's nuance, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, we cannot irrefutably prove that nobody has ever done it before in the entirety of human history, but it seems extremely unlikely that somebody did. But then it's like, if you get into paragraph speech rather than sentence hyperbole, suddenly it's, well, yes, but let's recognize that when it comes to traveling in the area that the Northwest Passage travels through, the Inuit are experts who've been traveling through this land for millennia. You know, they know what they're doing. They're gnarly. They're hardcore. Their way of life is under threat. Who are we to deny them modernity where they want it while simultaneously protecting cultural heritage? Like, these things, I sometimes get slightly frustrated by actually how simple some of these conversations are. But we like to create teams and sides where people who go there because they're, and when they're white, are the baddies. And people who like to talk about leaving these people to live in their huts in some kind of museum-like state think they're the goodies. But actually, it's so much more complicated than that.
Yeah, exactly.
So much more.
And I'm not like in a position to like take a side, but
you
are allowed
an opinion.
I remember how we got onto this, but
yeah,
I'm on the side of nuance.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, to quote, unfortunately, maybe, but to quote Alistair Campbell, it's like just disagree agreeably. Like,
yeah,
it's this whole idea, you know, if somebody's been listening to this last 5 minutes and thinks I disagree with everything Matt just said, well, email me.
Yeah, yeah.
But don't swear at me or shout at me.
Depending on the tone of your email, I may not reply.
Yeah, totally. No, and I've had numerous angry emails that I just don't bother replying to because that my mental health doesn't need it.
Yeah, yeah. I used to, when I first became a journalist, I found it really difficult not to reply to comments. And then I went through a phase of writing comments and deleting them just to give myself the catharsis of like replying without like getting into it. But yeah, there was like one guy in particular. Every time somebody commented, even if it was reasonable, like, oh, I completely disagree, et cetera, they'd comment on that comment saying, don't worry, we all know this guy in Hong Kong and he's a complete joke and nobody takes him seriously. And I'm like, Humber, what?
Yeah, like, totally.
I messaged him directly and said, let's go for a coffee. I don't know why I'm done to you, but...
Well, exactly. Some people are keyboard warriors and there are a few people who quite regularly email me because they listen to the podcast a lot and they are critical. But they are kind and I reply. You know, not all the time because I've got kids and I have sanity to consider. But I'll reply because I'm up for it. I'm a career conversationalist. Like, I like this stuff.
So, yeah, I love to debate, even if it's, I mean, I'll end up debating stuff I previously didn't care about just because I like the act of arguing.
Exactly.
Like, in good faith. Like, I'm not trying, if I can see that somebody's taking it personally, I'll back off. But I'd love to, you know, angrily debate, like, you know, Is Stephen Hawking a correct person to define time before time? Is it philosophical or scientific?
Yeah, yeah. It's fun if you're that sort of brain.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Well, this is fun, but in an attempt to drag us slightly back on track.
Yeah.
What do you think changed for you then after you did the two failed Ocean Rows and you had this kind of semi-identity crisis? Who am I? Do I have any validity? You know, you've mentioned that things changed for you in Hong Kong, but what had actually changed? What had changed for you intrinsically?
Well, it was less about changing and more about remembering, you know, or like reframing experiences before and thinking, why did I never thought about being a world record holder? There's nothing to indicate that I could be. As I said, I'm not like particularly athletic or fit. Like, and suddenly I thought I could set a world record for rowing. What? So it was more about remembering and re-examining the experiences I had before and why I enjoyed them, which sort of liberated me to then like take stuff on and say, look, I'm doing this because it's fun. And there were definitely a couple of like catalyst moments that went forward. The one that I mentioned before about running on the bad knee was helpful just to give me confidence to do other stuff. Then I entered a race in the Yukon to kayak down the Yukon River. And then COVID happened, so it didn't happen. But I'd already agreed with a friend to go like for a kayaking trip around Hong Kong. And I actually thought about not doing it because I can't be bothered now. It was just going to be training. I've seen all these places, hiking all around them. Kayaking's going to be no different. And then we had this epic five-day adventure. Really amazing. And the Hong Kong, the outdoors there is unbelievable. And we went to these like islands called Double Haven, which are these like natural harbors, so lagoons, perfectly flat water, beautiful. And we just camped, and there's only one little village on one of the towns and on one of the islands, and there's only one ferry that goes there once a week. So it really feels very isolated. We went for 5 days backwards and forwards. And then as we were coming back, we went along this very exposed bit of coastline with cliffs, and these swells are coming in and they were smashing off the cliffs and then bouncing back out. So creating this really confused water that were like spilling off each other and splashing up into the air. And this was honestly the first time I'd been sea kayaking, apart from like poodling around in like a sit on top and rent a thing. Even the boat I was in was not appropriate for this. So I had to really, really concentrate, and like momentum is stability on water. So I was like pushing as hard as I could. And every now and then I'd made my, you know, this was like 2 hours of just nonstop paddling, having never really done it before, without being able to take a second break, with these beautiful cliffs up beside me, this mountain called Sharp Peak towering over us, which I'd hiked so many times and now seeing it from a new angle. And then, you know, every now and then I'd lose concentration. It'd just be so long trying to focus that my hips would wiggle and I'd think I was about to go over. And I actually shout to myself, like, concentrate, concentrate, to try and like bring it back to the middle and keep them going. Trying to look over my shoulder, see if my kayaking mate was keeping up with me. He was in a bigger kayak, much more experienced. He was having no problem. But for me, you know, I was just absolutely focused on the moment, in the element, surrounded by this beautiful nature, at the mercy of nature, moving through it under my own power. So I felt like an extension of it. After 2 hours, I came around a corner into a cove. For the first time, was safe in a long time. And I just was like, this is what I've been looking for. You know, this is what I like pictured adventure to be. Nobody is going to do a headline about this. It's not a record. People have probably done that many times. And probably now that I'm more experienced, I'd probably go through that like with absolutely no problem at all. It was just the first thing I did. And that was a moment. That was a huge moment for me where I think I'd already come across the psychology of the discovery relationships and stuff. But that like really anchored it in the experience and made me think, this is what it means. You know, it's not in theory, I'm here for immersion in nature. But now, like that moment of coming around and being in the shelter, I like put my paddle down and lay back. And I was just like ecstatic because I'd enjoyed myself so much, but it felt more like I'd realized so much about what it was. So, and then me and that friend went on a number of other kayaking trips. We came into it. A storm once where these lightning bolts were like lighting up the island that we were trying to head to. And then when the storm passed, we were surrounded by these tuna for like an hour and they were like boiling the water. And then when we got to the islands, because of all the rain from the storm, there was these waterfalls coming like all the way up down into the water, these like cliffs straight down into the water. And I was just, it was just so rewarding. And that's also where I started kayaking. And if that anchors you in a point in time, that first one we went on, went away, was out of reception for 5 days, landed back, and my wife was like, have you heard? Britain's gone into lockdown. And like, I didn't know what that meant. I was like, what's lockdown? She said, lockdown, you know, like lockdown. And the word had become normal to the extent that it was strange that I didn't know what it was. Because on Monday, the word didn't exist. On Friday, I was expected to know it, even though I hadn't. So if that's, that puts a date on it.
Yeah.
And yeah, and in Hong Kong, we never really had lockdown. We had like restrictions on going to bars and stuff. But so that's why I started doing all of those kayaking tricks. And for me, COVID was probably a huge important time because, you know, it meant that I couldn't plan and sit at home and plan the next big expedition and not do stuff in between. I was like, well, there's nothing to do now. I'm going to go kayaking. So these experiences were massive for me in terms of rediscovering like what it was like. I liked about adventure, why I wanted to be an adventurer, and it was like liberating because you basically can't fail, you know. I don't get through the Northwest Passage, and then I've been surrounded by whales, and I've had ice moving around me, trapping me, almost killing me at one point. We stood on ice. We've seen polar bears. We were woken up by polar bears, like rubbing themselves against our tent, and they wouldn't leave. So we're throwing rocks at them, and birds. I love birds, and they're so, like, the flocks of them were just so incredible. And the sun at one point, when it wasn't setting, but it was like sitting on the horizon because it's 24-hour sunlight, just turned all of the ice around us orange, like beautiful dark orange right the way up to our kayaks. It wasn't just on the horizon because the ice was in the water. Everything turned orange. And then on our left, the moon came up as well. It turned all of the ice on our left purple. So I had this beautiful, perfect line down the middle of my kayak where one side of the world was orange and one side of the world was purple, like a surreal painting that's like colliding of two worlds. And then an hour later, that just is over. And the only people who've seen it is us four. And we've had to work hard to see it and be there. You know, let's say I finish 100 miles short of the Northwest Passage because we ran out of food. Like, who's telling me that's a failure?
Totally.
I've ended up going spilling. So it was a slow journey of going a lot of different adventures that rather than like discovering, I rediscovered what it was I was there for.
Yeah. And because, you know, let's go on to talk about the Northwest Passage in a sec. But I think because, spoiler alert, you didn't fail.
But 189 miles in the end, it really felt like we would. And that was definitely the worst I felt.
Yeah. But I'm interested in this idea of failure. It's actually a conversation I was having with a friend the other day at length, hours at home, because some people are terrified of failure, actively opposed to it. And almost like it's so crippling, this idea of failure, that they won't even actually try anything that's outside of their comfort zone or risks failure. And there are all sorts of reasons I think we develop this fear of failure, but you have failed at numerous things. I have failed at many things. I mean, I won't tell you the story, but I've failed at ultramarathons so badly I've needed proper physiotherapy at length. And I reflect on those as wholly positive experiences because of what they've done to me as a person. Where do you sit on this idea of failure now, and how comfortable are you with it? Do you seek it? Do you risk it?
I think of the Northwest Passage as like an 8-year-long journey, which started with the first time I failed the Atlantic. Even before I tried to row the Atlantic the first time, literally the week before, I called a guy who wanted to row the Northwest Passage. I said, I'm about to row the Atlantic. We're going to set the world record. When I get back, let's talk about the Northwest Passage. I assumed that I needed something on my CV that was impressive enough to get him to take me to the Northwest Passage. And that was the person I tried to organize rowing the Northwest Passage with initially. And for 3 years, we were all in part of the team together, and it went bitterly wrong. So when I talk about the Northwest Passage, I think of that whole thing. I think of it like a character arc, you know, going from there to where I am now, and with a really neat ending as well. Like I feel like that's over. So I'm very glad that those two failures happened, because they, without them, even if I had achieved the Northwest Passage, I feel like I would be proud of the achievement, but would I be content? You know, so many people have post-expedition blues. I've heard of a study where people who go to the Olympics, whether they win gold or they lose, they both feel the same sense of emptiness, because you achieve the goal, then what? You know, so what? You expect to feel different, but you don't. Yeah. So without those failures, it forced me to reflect on what it was I was getting out of it. It means that I am both proud of the achievement and content with the experience, which could be mutually exclusive. So I'm very happy I failed, incredibly happy, because the worst thing would be to go through all of that to get through the Northwest Passage, then come back and think, yeah, it was all right, but I wish I was still there or something, or I wish I had another goal. Now I feel like, I guess I feel more comfortable to fail in the future because I'm less defensive about it, you know? I sort of compulsively brought up the Atlantic to a lot of friends always. Oh, well, in the Atlantic, we did this and there was these swells and there was this stuff. And I guess in hindsight, it was more defensive to prove that actually it was cool. It wasn't just pathetic. Whereas I happily talk about the Northwest Passage if it comes up, but I don't feel myself so compulsively doing it. So I guess I'd be more comfortable to take on something I'd be likely to fail in the future, safe in the knowledge that, you know, at the end of the day, I'm European Adventurer of the Year. I don't need any massive validation. So I guess it's like that does circle back to the outcome.
Yeah.
I guess if I was to do something else soon, it wouldn't be so goal-orientated anyway. So yeah, in time, we'll find out how I feel about failure. It's typical to say only probably 15 weeks since I got back.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But I think it's also interesting, this idea of success, because, you know, I've alluded to this lots on this podcast, but I had a big block of therapy years ago and it really changed who I am as a person for the better. And I've interviewed a lot of people who move in our worlds. And whilst I'm in no way a data analyst, I think I've sort of got this kind of qualitative anecdotal evidence that objective success does not equal happiness.
Yeah, and I've heard the term destination addiction.
Yeah, totally.
And you arrive at destination and you're addicted to finding another one to work towards. It's like,
your Olympics example is really interesting, because I didn't know that. And I think that's so true of our world, actually. I think that
somebody might have to fact check that. It's like told to me, like over a drink. Oh, I read about this research. I've read the research.
But I'm not surprised. I think it's the same as like the actual physical, chemical dopamine hit of buying a Ferrari lasts as long as the nicotine from smoking a cigarette. which again, fact check me, but I think it's a cool story nonetheless.
Yeah.
You know, there's the cheesy quote, it's from Prince, but he said, I've been to the top of the mountain and there's nothing there.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, this whole idea, whether I've interviewed people who've been successful, whether they've failed, I don't think either of those things are necessarily the marker for whether or not they're happy, content, motivated. I think it's much more a correlation between whether their goals are intrinsic or extrinsic. Are they seeking fame and validity? Are they seeking the record so they can go in the book? Or are they looking for a positive experience of themselves or with friends? And I think I could probably prove that if somebody analyzed the 170 interviews we've done for this podcast.
Yeah, well, I think that it's not bad to have all... You know, basically, I sometimes when I give talks to like finances or something, the way I phrase it is like, I diversified my portfolio of motivations to de-risk myself, you know? I haven't dropped the investment in the performance. I just have other things as well. And ideally, I would like to finish the Northwest Passage, have an experience of immersion in nature, and leave with friends for life. But it doesn't all rest on one or the other.
Yeah.
Towards the end, though, when you're like that close, and it was getting so, so hard, everybody said, you can't be here like into September. And a lot of people we met when we were in a town in Cambridge Bay, halfway, who were sailors or canoe party or some hikers who hiked across Victoria Island, saying, we're leaving now. You know, you can't be here, not in kayaks. So we were still there in mid-October, and that was savage. And you're like, and that's when you're so close, you do become a bit outcome focused. Like, I know, fine, I had a beautiful experience of discovery in the first half. I'm like 100 miles from the end, we cannot mess up now. And I actually felt like a lot of pressure. I think I said to my teammates at the time, like, this feels like we're in the last 5 minutes of the Rugby World Cup final with 3 points ahead, and all we need to do is not give a penalty. Like, we don't need to do anything, just don't mess up. And that pressure manifested itself in a lot of different ways. Like, we became more conservative in some ways, and, you know, like, nobody wants to get the, like, summit fever. And that hamstrung us in some ways as well, because we didn't take a weather window on the Tuesday, knowing that there was a better one on the Thursday. And we... Even as that weather window was happening, we were looking out to sea. We were like, we definitely should have taken this one. This is perfect. What were we thinking? Oh, well, at least it's Thursday. And then the Thursday one shut. And then there wasn't another one on the forecast, like 10 days, but we had about 7 days of food. And that was my lowest moment. I was like, I cannot believe we've done this to ourselves. Like, and I felt responsible because I was so tired that day. when we woke up at 3 a.m. and it was windy, we sort of all said, oh, it's more windy than we expected. Should we not go? And I felt like I could have said, come on, let's at least get up and pack the tent. And if it's bad, the worst thing we have to do is put the tent up again. But instead, I said, yeah, let's sleep in. And I like still felt like I was grabbing at the excuse again. So I was so livid with myself. And then a weather window, thank God, appeared on the Friday and we took it and finished Northwest Passage 3 days later. So I had become outcome focused in some ways. And in other ways, we were speaking about this before on the podcast, like I'm a father now. And often when things were difficult, I'd think about how much I struggled to get to the start, how much support I had from my parents, how my belief in myself and my opportunities to do this is, you know, either directly or intangibly linked to all of the support I got as a child from my parents. And now it's my turn to do that and pass it on, which in some ways, dirty as it sounds, is about like having a good career. And if I finish the next 100 miles and become the first person to kayak the Northwest Passage with my team, the Arctic Cowboys, then I will get more talks. Somebody will buy my book. And I will be able to give the opportunities to my daughter and my now son as well that I had. And if I mess up now and I go home and I have a intrinsic experience of being in nature, that won't help my kids. I just felt this immense amount of pressure. And I actually spoke to Eileen, who was in the kayak with me, a lot about it. Like, we've got to start being present again. You know, let's stop counting the miles. You know, we'll never have this day again. And we'll never see this sunset again. And we'll never see this color again. It was like towards the end, it was a battle to like try and balance the two. But
I love how honest you are about it all, because I think lots aren't. And I like that line, you know, diversify my portfolio of motivations. I think that's really wise. And I've felt a lot of what you've just been discussing or explaining, because, you know, and again, I won't bore you with my experiences of it, but I've had moments where the pressure to do the thing, usually because it's a job and I'm in a remote location, and the ultimate consequence of failure is death for me or somebody else. But the likely consequence of failure is we don't do the job we're here to do. And that can be crippling.
Mm.
But actually, I think that whether you're in a kayak or whether you're on a mountain in Alaska, just thinking, well, what do we do next? You know, if the weather is too bad to move, we probably shouldn't move. If the weather's good enough to move, let's move and let's paddle hard. And it's actually breaking these things down into, you know, the next 10 minutes, the next hour, the next day, with an understanding of what the next week involves, is really the only way to move forwards.
Yeah.
Stops you making terrible decisions and getting really bad summit fever.
Yeah. But the one thing that I do like about the performance aspect is it requires you to push, and like it requires you to make these decisions. You know, a year and a half ago, I kayaked down the part of the west coast of Scotland, picking where I went day by day, and stopping at the base of Munros and climbing the Munros from sea level as I went. Great adventure. Really loved it. Was slightly less rewarding because there was the goal. So the performance does force you to push, maybe like work on the edge of what's acceptable in terms of risk, like make those decisions, especially when there's a time limit, like winter is coming. And that facilitates the relationships, because friendship becomes camaraderie, like through the struggle. You know, the people I kayaked down the West Coast with, I had one friend for the first week, a different friend for the second week. What an epic shared experience. We'll have a beer in a year and say, oh, remember that day when we did this? But it won't be like, you know, wow, we dug for each other. So I guess like one question I sometimes get is like, well, since you moved away from wanting the record so badly to wanting an experience, do you train less hard? Do you find it hard to train? Like, you know, oh, well, you know, if I'm modest fit, we don't achieve it. Well, at least I've been in nature and had camaraderie. But no, I train harder because like although an extrinsic goal is tangible, we derive at a place which marks the end of the Northwest Passage and have a title next to our name. That's real, and camaraderie is abstract. When you're 1,000 miles away from that real place and you're deciding whether to dig deep, you look at your teammate, that is more real than the end. That's not abstract. You're there. You have to dig. And if you want camaraderie, you're going to make sure that you aren't letting the team down Like, how undermined would your camaraderie be if, like, your social cohesion is great, but you're the one who's like, the task cohesion is completely undermined by your like inability to do it. So it's way more powerful to train to do something together than train to have an outcome together. So, like, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, like, it's all, like, interlinked for me, you know. And then the immersion in nature is more rewarding because I'm sharing with people I care about, and I care about them because we're working towards a performance goal together hard. So, you know, it's like it all feeds back in a massive loop for me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we're into full, like, philosophy and psychology here in a way, which I like. But I think often, you know, this whole idea of, I mean, to use another Olympic example, you know, it's like Usain Bolt breaking the world record for the 100 meters. Is he elated simply because he's now the world record holder and because he beat everybody else on that track? Or how much of the past 20 years feeds into that moment of glory? And I think that's, when we look at adventures, journeys, expeditions, we get to the finish line, and if we've achieved something that no one's ever done before, like a first ascent or like a first crossing, we tend to, like, hang the reward structure on that title, that thing that we did. But actually, if you unpack it, you go, well, what was amazing? What are we proud of? What did we achieve? Yeah, sure, you know, we've got this title, this almost like this umbrella that is covering this vast quantity of experiences and moments, whether that was that moment sat on that ledge with that friend who will be a friend for life, or whether it was because that day was really difficult and we thought we were going to fail, but we didn't because we gritted our teeth. Like, it's this wrapper for dozens and dozens and dozens and hundreds of micro experiences all wrapped up. And I think it's so easy to kind of forget that, so easy to not reflect on those experiences and see that as the positive. Like, the journey is the destination is the cheesy bullshit line, but it is true.
I say that now all the time. Like, it's the journey, or I said at the beginning, like, you know, adventure isn't about when you start and when you finish, it's everything in between. And then this language that I've got now from this, like, one piece of psychology, which I've, like, hung all of my hat off, which isn't supposed to be self-help. It's just meant to be a framework that a psychologist wrote to understand why people do stuff. But for me, it's been very helpful.
I've written it down.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, like, it's more like easy to say, oh, enjoy the journey, not the outcome. Cool. How? It's like, what does the journey mean? And now, like, I have this language. For me, this is what the journey means. Like, it means immersion in nature and camaraderie. And it helps me, like, remind myself, like, when we're going slowly, well, this is beautiful. Or the next time I pick something, it'll give me, you know, if somebody says, hey, do you want to be the first person to row this place or that place? I'll think, well, I'm not interested in that place, or, like, I don't know these people, so am I going to get camaraderie or whatever? I guess I didn't know the Arctic Cowboys when I started. I literally met them for the first time, like, 5 days before we started. So I guess it undermines it, but they seemed nice, obviously.
Yeah, but that's then, you know, your performance discovery in relationships is this nice triangle. It's like, is this thing I'm about to embark on going to tick all of those boxes to a high enough standard that it's worth doing? If the answer is
no. It doesn't have to tick all of three, like, sometimes, and knowing which one it is. When I did that West Coast thing, you know, I was possibly a bit faster at kayaking than some of them. So, you know, if it was with me or by myself, I would have picked maybe further away or done something a bit faster. Yeah. And while we're going slowly, if there was a performance goal, then I would be like, come on, come on, come on. And you're undermining my camaraderie goal because we're, you know, not in this together. But knowing that this one isn't about that means, fine, okay, fine, we do 20K instead of 40K today. And then on another one that is performance goal, it, like, allows you to approach everything, like, differently, just being like, okay, what is it you want from here? Therefore, what are we going to do? Like, if this one is heavily about discovery in nature, and somebody suggests, well, you know, we're passing a town, why don't we get an Airbnb for the night? I'll say, well, actually, what, I'm here to camp. whereas if it's like, right, it's a performance goal, we'll be better and more refreshed from an Airbnb. Like, it informs you while you're doing it and everything. And it doesn't always have to be like the holy trinity of all three. Each one can have different things. And whatever I do next will have much less performance in it, I think.
Yeah. And then maybe to close this chapter off, because I sense we could probably do this for a little while. I think my view on it is there are no rules as long as the rules you create are, as long as the rules you create, you stick to them. You know, yeah. if you're going to then claim something at the end, which the wider public, whether that's 10 people or 10 million people, have to believe, make the rules and stick to them. If you're not doing it for anybody else, you don't need any rules and there aren't any. If on day three of your trip, where you've decided you're going to camp every night for 20 days, you decide to get an Airbnb because you're tired and wet and something's gone wrong, okay. If you're comfortable with that because you're just there for anything, do it. Get the Airbnb. Slow down. It's beautiful weather, so you don't want to go out today. You want to lay on that beach and read your book. That's okay.
Exactly, yeah. It's like, retrospectively changing. We got a bit of a heat online because we said we were finishing in a place called Tuktoyaktuk because it's the nearest town to the place where the end of the Northwest Passage is. But on our website, we'd always said this is the end of the Northwest Passage. And then as the season got so late, we said we're not going to get to Tuktoyaktuk. We're going to finish at the Northwest Passage, then try and arrange something, which was initially a boat, but then it got even too late in the season for a boat to get there. So we went to an airport, and like an abandoned airport, and people were saying, oh, so now you're defining the Northwest Passage 200 miles short just because of the... And we're like, no, read our website. We just said we were going to cut to do it to Agder because that was the closest place to the place we finished and took a lot of... So we were getting that abuse. I mean, I'm getting this abuse all secondhand because we didn't have the internet, but I'm getting like 160 character text. I'm like, I don't care. If you're still telling me about it. I'm trying to...
Yeah, you know.
Everybody's angry online. I know. Yeah. Everybody's always angry online. Leave me alone.
Yeah, it's one of the dangers of the modern world. I mean, Shackleton had no idea what anybody thought about him at the time.
Yeah.
He was just focused on not dying.
Yeah.
You know, there's a beauty to that in lots of ways.
Mm.
So, 50 minutes into this conversation...
Tell me about the Northwest Passage.
I think it might be worth talking a bit about the Northwest Passage.
Yeah, so the Northwest Passage is the Arctic route that links the Atlantic to the Pacific. Historically, the reason... we as Europeans were interested in it because it sounded like a shortcut to Asia for trading, particularly Britain. The first people who went there, first Europeans who went specifically to look for the Northwest Passage, Martin Frobisher in the 1570s, is because go around South America, you've got to go a long way. It's Cape Horn and it's past all the Spanish colonies. You've got to go around Cape of Good Hope. It's all the Dutch colonies. Maybe we can go over the top. But it was full of ice. So nobody got very far. And it took 300 years to like map all the different bits and finally find like a reasonable linked up waterway that wasn't blocked by land. Most famously is a guy, John Franklin, who a BBC series called The Terror about him disappearing. We camped very close to his sunken ship, The Terror, probably, I don't know, within 10 or 20 miles of it. And then the first person to make it all the way through was Roald Amundsen, the guy who was first at the South Pole. And even he took 3 years because he would get a little bit of headway and then it would freeze over and then a little bit of headway and then it'd freeze over. And in 2007, it was ice free for the first time. So people, spoiler alert, climate change. So people started thinking maybe we could do this by human power. And for about a decade now, people have, there's been rowing teams, kayaking teams, various like semi-assisted rowing / small sail teams trying to get through by human power. And even this year, when we started, there was two other rowing teams, two single guys and two single rowing boats as a pair coming from the other end, and a rowing boat in like one of those classic ocean rowing boats that you sleep on coming from the same end as us. And they started a long time after us. And neither of them finished. So we became the first, which was awesome. And it was very, very, very amazing. And I was going to say difficult. The difficulty was like the uncertainty. You know, if you row the Atlantic, difficulty is the physical grind of doing 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 2 hours on, 2 hours off. And there were definitely physically difficult days. And then the last 10 days, I really just hit a wall and was holding on by my fingernails for dear life. But up until that point, the difficulty had been like the differences in opinion in the team, the weather is good enough to go or not good enough to go today. We all had different approaches. You know, West and Jeff were much slower getting ready in the morning and then just wanted to get on the water and be in the boat going fast forever, whereas Eileen and I wanted to be more dynamic, get ready quickly, take short weather windows here and there. These kind of things were the difficulty. And the uncertainty is just like, you know, every time you're on land for like a 3-day storm or 6-day storm as we were, like you're just counting the days. Winter is coming. People say we can't be here past mid-September, and you know, it is mid-September. Now it's, you know, these days. And in the beginning, we were stuck on shore for 2 weeks before we even started. These are the difficulties. But it was amazing, absolutely amazing. And as I say, those are the three things I wanted from it, and those are the three things I got from it. Like, we achieved this thing, great. The experiences in nature were really diverse. I thought that a huge part of this would be monotony, 10 hours of kayaking day, whatever. It's like just ticking away the miles and trying to like think of something to pass the time, but it was so diverse. And the first third was full of sea ice, you know, very dynamic, moving around us, sometimes trapping us on shore. And that was beautiful and amazing. And next to the sea ice is like an ecosystem where there's bowhead whales and there's narwhal and beluga and polar bears, so many polar bears coming very, very close. And our attitude to them changed. The first time we're like out there with our guns or screaming at it and firing flares. And sort of a few weeks in, we heard a clang outside our tent. I didn't even hear it. Jeff opens the door, slowly puts his head out and goes, "Oh man, there's a polar bear here. Oh, go on, get. Go on, get." Oh, it's gone. And then he just comes back into the tent. And then they're like, "Maybe we should go back out and make sure it's properly gone." And they went out and gave it like a big scare. You know, that's like 2 meters or 3 meters away from us. But the narwhals were definitely some of the most rewarding. You know, the Arctic whale with the big ivory tusk swimming around us. At one point, they lined up in front of us, like 10 of them. Wherever we like moved, they just stayed parallel to us for about 15 minutes. We just floated there, Eileen tapping the side of the kayak to try and keep them interested. Eventually, one of them put his head up as though he was looking at us. And it was like a signal to the rest of them. They all rolled onto their side like a synchronized swimming team and disappeared. And then the middle third was really flat and grim. Like, you couldn't see the land you were heading towards until you're a mile away. So, you know, I took charge of navigation for many of those crossings. And, you know, I'm just staring down at the GPS, left, right, left, left, right. And I found that so mentally draining. Like, you know, even if I was trying to have a conversation just to pass the time. "Yeah, no, I totally agree. No, a little bit left. No, yeah, well, me and my wife, we also, not a little bit right." You know, it's like just, you can't stay in the moment. You can't enjoy the nature. You can't have the camaraderie. Left, right, left, right. And the water was disappearing. So instead of running fresh water from glaciers, like in the first third, you're scooping water out of these like grim little puddles full of, you know, goose poo. And then the final third was like just a race against time before winter came. And we started like really putting the foot down, like 40-mile day, 30-mile day, which were huge for us. And then winter did come. And that came with its own problems, that aside from the cold, things you didn't expect, like all the fresh water's frozen. So Eileen and I, once, this is actually after we finished the Northwest Passage and we're trying to kayak to the like airport, we just walked, I don't know how many hours it was, to try and find a place to get water. And that was a challenge. But equally, like, when everything was just white, you've been kayaking in the snow, you're warm because you're exercising and you've got a dry suit on and hood, but the snow's like drifting around you. It's just a different world entirely to anything you've experienced before. So so diverse and so like awesome and just amazing to be there. Like, and then there's the history as well. You know, like I said, the Europeans trying to find it. And there was one story in particular. There's a beach called Fury Beach where this Captain Parry got stuck there in like 1818. He's trying to get his boat through, but all this ice was swirling around them on the tide and the wind. So in like a mad dash, they crashed onto the beach and then left their boat there and then went and camped somewhere else. And then this beach became like a safe haven for all the expeditions over the next decades. They'd be like, "We're stuck, but if we can get to Fury Beach, we know all the food's still left there from the abandoned boat." And we were trying to land on Fury Beach. And this is something that was supposed to be about 10 hours. And we were just 1 hour away from shore. All this ice moved in and it was swirling around us and spilling over itself like lava. You could just see it rushing by like a river. And at one point we were sitting between two massive ice floes and they just changed direction, slammed into the side of mine and Eileen's kayak, which should have crushed us. But instead it pinched the bottom and like lifted us up into the air. And it took hours and hours. And once we were after we'd almost been crushed, we got out of kayaks and just stood on the ice floe, and it was still moving and floating south. We just drifted past Fury Beach. Any chance of landing there was over. West in particular was, really engaged in history. And I think very looking forward to being on Fury Beach. I could see he was a bit crestfallen. I said, look, West, if you want to know what it was like to be parried by going to Fury Beach, I promise you, being unable to reach Fury Beach because you're stuck in moving ice on the wind and tide, you've had a far more Captain Parry experience than you ever would have found been if you'd been there finding a trinket. So many things were just amazing. You know, I've crammed so much into there. It was 103 days between being dropped off at the start and actually getting back to the airport at the end, with a stop in the middle at Cambridge Bay to like restock on food and get some other supplies. So it was fantastic.
Maybe you should write a book about it.
Oh, well, funny you should mention that. Yeah, yesterday I signed my book deal with Icon Publishers. So I'm very, very chuffed with that. And the psychology that we've spoken about comes into the book a lot. I try and like put some chapters in there about the psychologists I spoke to, because I actually called the people who wrote that performance narrative thing and said, how can it apply to me? Hopefully it's a good book, but I'm going to enjoy writing it.
You've got to write it first, yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably a grander adventure than the one you've just been on, if and what my friends have said is anything to go by.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I find myself stuck writing the book, and then I start and I write like 10,000 words, and then I don't do anything again for a while. And my agent was like, hey, hang on, you wrote these three chapters last night. You don't rush it. I'm like, I didn't rush it because I didn't do anything else for the month before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's it. Ace, well, yeah, we could talk about the Northwest Passage in so much more detail, but I mean, maybe we will another day, like genuinely, you know, when the book's finished or when it's nearly done or when it's out, you know, let's do that story in full. Couple of things I'd like to ask you, just little notes I've made throughout before we close, if you have the time. You know, towards the start, you mentioned this whole idea of almost this gentle or not purposeful need to create stories for the grandkids. And do you feel like in some way that's a burden, like this familial history, this legacy that has been put on you? Is that a burden or is that a privilege?
Well, in many ways, tangibly, it is a privilege. You know, I'm clearly privileged, and being in the outdoors is normal for me. And I never like second guessed it. The conversation has been going on over the last few years makes me realize that just like having it as a normalcy, it is a massive privilege. I definitely suffer from like an existential dread that I'm not doing something interesting. Like I'm wasting my time, and there's only so much time, and I've got to do it all. And it's like not just like it's not FOMO. It's maybe even the opposite when I'm just like doing something like drinking in a pub, and I'm like, why am I in the mountains or you know, doing something epic? And that I'm sure has come from many places, including you know the many interesting stories in my family. So many of my family have books written about them, and my wife pointed that out to me once, and I was like, oh, this is my great uncle in this book, and they're like, oh my gosh, there's somebody in your family who hasn't written a book about you. I was like, oh god, yeah, maybe that's why I'm doing this. So yeah, I guess it's like it's both huge privilege, it's not a burden, because the things that it like that pressures me to do are awesome and fun. You know, I guess it's like less of a burden than if I was like felt burdened to become a millionaire. Like, oh, everybody in your family is a millionaire, and you must, even at the expense of your own enjoyment and stuff. Like, I'm feeling like a pressure to go and do amazing, interesting things, and I feel less of a pressure now because I've done something. Although it was so recent that maybe it will return, but I still want to do stuff, and I. Even before I started, I knew what like my next adventures would be. So yeah, it's delightful to have. And also, I guess, pointing out, it's not like you have to get stories to the grandkids, you're on your own. You have to get stories for the grandkids, and then my parents are like, and here we are to help.
Yeah, I find it fascinating, that whole idea. I mean, I think so much of societal pressure feeds into that these days as well, that need to be successful. And that word is a very dangerous, dirty word. It can mean lots of different things. I mean, success for some people is living a calm, healthy life that is devoid of pressure and stress. Success for some people is making 10 million. Success for some people is being the first person to do the last great first crossing backwards. You know, it's as long as we have a healthy relationship with those success markers and that motivation, then I guess we're doing things right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, success for me is basically being happy, which I am. I'm so content. And being a good supportive father like I had. Those are sort of the two things I care about now.
Yeah. Ace. Well, that is a nice way to end it. So it leads me naturally onto my closing questions, which you've said you listen to this podcast, so you might be aware of what's coming. Mm-hmm. What scares you?
Screens and social media and I guess both of those in tandem for like micro and macro reasons. Like micro, because I am father now, and you know, we've managed to basically not give our 20 month year old screens so far. We will eventually, because you need them in life. But we give her them for a few minutes when Sophie cuts her nails, like every week or two. And during that 5 minute process, she's just staring at them. I'm like, it's like sedating them. You know, it makes me feel sad. I'm like, oh, and I also don't want to be like a snobby parent. Like, we don't give our kids screens. So like, you know, sure, we're not like, she goes on FaceTime and talks to grandparents and stuff. And so from a parent point of view, that's something that will come. And when she's a teenager, particularly statistically, it seems girls on Instagram and whatever the social media is at the time, it's a challenge. But on a macro level, I just feel like social media and screens are like a huge snowball, which we don't know where it's going to go. You know, we take for granted now that it polarized us. But imagine if you said in 2007, have you seen that new college social media thing? Yeah, that's going to polarize the world and make Trump president. What? You know? So, like, who knows where it's going to go? You talk about echo chambers, which the algorithms are doing. Well, what about, imagine how, you know, people over 30 are on Facebook, people under 30 aren't, they're on Instagram, and then below that's TikTok, and then what's next and what's next? What happens in 50 years' time where the 80-year-olds are on one platform, the 70-year-olds are on a different, the 60-year-olds are on another, they're all on different platforms. That might not just be as simple as an echo chamber. That might be like, you know, this generation have short attention spans because they had TikTok, and the next generation only consume long form content because something else became popular, and they just are unable to communicate, or the polarization is 1,000 times more, or maybe the creativity is even better because you have a diversity of different approaches where some people are like, let's get things done quickly, and other people are like, let's get things done, you know, slowly.
Yes. So
I just think that the way it is going is like, for somebody smarter than me to predict, but I feel like it's so young, you know, and we can't all engage in an activity for essentially like 2 or 3 hours a day or more, and it not to have some kind of massive, profound effect, which it already is having, but is going to be bigger and more unpredictable.
Yeah, I think lots of us like to pretend it's not having an effect on us, and we're slightly, you know, holier than thou. Like, I don't have too much screen time and I'm not deeply affected by it. Well, of course.
I am. Yeah, I'm like addicted, you know, I'm like staring at my Instagram, like scrolling through like absolute like inane stuff, and I'm like, what am I doing? Like, you know, I try really hard, and obviously I don't succeed at this, but just not to be on my phone in front of my kids.
Yeah.
And like, I'm even more worried about that than I have. They will have screen time. They already have a little bit of screen time, and they probably will have a lot in the times to come. But I just don't want them to create an atmosphere where they think that this is what people do. And just a simple remedy is I have a book, which is like a little anecdote book. So you can dip in and out. You don't have to like read it. And if my kid doesn't want to play with me and I'm just sitting there, I just pick that up instead of the phone, just so the behavior I'm modeling is going into a book. And as soon as I pick up the book, she wants to read it with me. So I get through about three lines at a time. And am I going to be able to do that forever? Or, you know, should I constantly have a book around and not be on my phone? And I'm sometimes on my phone. And it's just something that I worry about. And it's who knows where it's going to go. It's just like huge, huge snowball that is already out of Pandora's box.
Yeah. It's almost like we don't know how not to be entertained anymore. I think that's something that expeditions are really good at, is like, I don't have any phone signal now. And
I've read
I'm
a
in
quote
my tent.
Bliss is on the other side of boredom. But it's on the other side. You've got to get through that first. So sometimes you're like, I'm so bored. And then eventually you end up like tapping into something that isn't. I brought a phone and headphones on the trip because I thought I'll listen to podcasts when it's really boring. And I'd never, like, I looked, I used it as a camera, and I just didn't need it for one second.
See, I'm the opposite. I don't see it as a mistake, but I do regret it in some ways. I skied across Vatnajökull, which is the largest ice cap in Western Europe, as part of a film project. And a couple of the guys there deliberately didn't bring headphones because they wanted to just experience the skiing every day, the monotony of it, and to get, like it's well phrased, you know, that bliss beyond boredom. I listened to 6 audiobooks on that expedition. It was like 14 days. So that, I was listening all day, every day, when I wasn't filming, to audiobooks.
As you said, you don't regret it. How do you feel about it? You have like mixed feelings. I wish I hadn't done that. Those books were great.
I'm quite good with, I don't sit there cross with myself because I did it. When I say regret it, what I mean is I look back on that and I say, I actually had a wonderful time listening to a huge diverse range of books in an incredible landscape. But next time I do something like that, I'm going to not take the audiobooks. And I'm going to see what that does to me. It's like just a learning experience rather than, oh my God, what an idiot.
Yeah, I have one friend who I've had this conversation with, because when I kayak with him, he puts headphones in immediately. And then if we start talking, he'll like just take them out, begin talking. And if the conversation like drifts out, just puts them back in.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but don't you want to like be immersed in nature and stuff? And he's like, I have several senses. I'm listening to a book and I'm being immersed in nature. Like, he doesn't understand why. He's like, these things are mutually exclusive. I'm right now listening to, The Rise of Stalin, and I'm looking at a beautiful bird in the sunset. Yeah. Like, I don't understand why you can't do both at once. And I'm like, I don't know. It just feels like, I don't know. maybe you're right. Maybe I'm too anal about it.
There's no wrong answer, but I do think there is a like switch off. Like, we all need to learn how to do that again.
Yeah.
Anyway, that wasn't one question.
Yeah.
What brings you hope?
What brings me hope is the belief, although belief is maybe the wrong word because that sounds all like faith, like rooted in research and countless studies, but like basically on the scale of nature versus nurture, I think that people think nature has a way outweighed, like it's got too much weight in the argument. Like, it's all nurture. And if it is nurture, then you can nurture yourself in a different way. You know, it's not, you can change, you can train, you can become fitter, you can become more creative, you can become more relaxed, you can become more driven, you can become more goal orientated if you feel like you aren't, like, whatever it is, you have actually so much bandwidth to ultimately control that by changing whatever it is that you need to nurture different things, which is something I, again, try and be conscious of as a parent. I just think, and somebody in the comment section will say, well, this research says that it's 90% nature. Well, you can also find research other ways. So I'm sure that it's a balance, but I just feel like people just think that they are set in stone and they're not. And the belief that you're not, like, liberates me to think, like, who or what could I be next?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think, like, I try to use this cheesy line all the time in my own head, which is just, we can get better. You know, whether that's as a society, as a species, as a human, as an individual, we can get better. You know, and I'm sort of living proof of that in lots of ways for myself. It's on us to do it, though.
Yeah, easier said than done.
Yeah. Ace, well, as I've said already in this podcast, I sense we could do this for a few hours, but that was really fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, then you can email me at matt@terraincognita.studio. And finally, as always, please do leave us an honest review on iTunes. They're a big help, and it really does help us bring the podcast to a wider audience.